that through the rule of Masa Avos Simin Labanim, that whatever happens to our forefathers is a sign for us, that Yaakov's encounter with Esav is a prototype for the encounter that a Jew has in hostile environments and galus. And all of us know the famous statement of Chazal that Yaakov had a multi-dimensional approach to his confrontation with Esav, right? Yaakov did three things. Yaakov sent Esav gifts, cooperation, reaching out, inclusiveness, friendship. Yaakov was prepared for milchava, for war, if that became necessary. And ultimately, of course, Yaakov turned to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in tefillah to be able to get the siyata d'shmaya, the divine help, to be able to engage in that encounter. First of all, it's very interesting that there's a machlokas rishonim. And again, I don't remember if I mentioned this last week. I apologize if I repeated it. But there is a machlokas rishonim if Yaakov should have contacted Esav at all. Because if you remember, if you look at the psukim, Yaakov sends Esav a message that I lived with Laban and I kept these mitzvahs. And then he hears back, Esav is coming after him with 400 men. And of course the Medrash says it's 400 generals, each of whom has an army. So Ramban takes the position. Ramban says, Yaakov shouldn't have sent a message to Esav at all. Remember, if you know the geography here, where does Esav live? Esav lives in a territory that is called Mount Seir, Har Seir. Where is Mount Seir? These are the mountains that are directly south of the Dead Sea, which is northern Saudi Arabia, right before the desert, Mount Seir. So Yaakov is entering Eretz Yisrael, coming from Haran, which is northeast, and he's entering around Shechem. Shechem is north of Yerushalayim. That's one of Yaakov's first stops. So Esav is hundreds of miles away. So the Ramban says, you know, if you wouldn't have told Esav that you're coming, things would have been fine. And Ramban quotes a pasuk in Mishlei that says, "Machzik biyazne kelev over al riv lo lo." He who gets involved in quarrels in which he didn't have to get involved in is like pulling the ears of a dog. We have an expression in English, of course, "Let sleeping dogs lie." In other words, what are you stirring up trouble? So the Ramban's position was, Yaakov made a mistake in even getting involved. It worked out well. Esav happened to be impressed with Yaakov. It's very interesting. Esav, according to the simple reading, does not come across as such a bad guy. He kind of forgives Yaakov. And one even gets the impression he's surprised that Yaakov did as well as he did. You know, Esav had the feeling, perhaps, that Yaakov was a yeshiva person, a student, a studious person who couldn't make it in the world. And when he sees that Yaakov has accomplished a lot, even materially, Esav is impressed, but he tells Yaakov, you know, you can take your gift, I don't need it. And he even offers to accompany Yaakov, to escort him. And Yaakov's response is, don't call me, I'll call you. You go back and I'll give you, I'll get in contact with you later, which Chazal say will not happen until Mashiach, really, but okay. But the Ramban says he shouldn't have gotten involved at all. Now the Sepurno, interestingly enough, rather than criticizing Yaakov, looks at what Yaakov did as an example of how a Jew should behave in Golas. The Sepurno points out that because of Yaakov's friendship and outreach to Esav, and his calling Esav Adoni, my master, and his referring to himself as Avdecha, your servant, because of that, the Sepurno says, that is why Esav was so friendly and disposed towards Yaakov, and it was a good thing. And the Sepurno quotes a very interesting Gemara. The Gemara says in Maseches Tainis, actually a very, very fascinating statement, where the Gemara says, based on a pasuk, that the curse of a friend is better than the blessing of an enemy. And it says, and it compares it to Bilam. Bilam, who of course is our enemy, blesses us by calling us a cedar. We're like Arazim, which is a blessing of our enemy. Achia Hashiloni, who gave rebuke, one of the Nevi'im, who gave rebuke to Yeravam ben Nevat, said, you will be like a kana, you will be like a reed that will be blown around in the wind. So one is a blessing and one is a curse. But the Gemara says, the blessing of a cedar can really be a curse in disguise, because when you're very strong and rigid, if the wind is too powerful, you crack and you bend, you break. As opposed to a reed, which, you know, moves around, but its flexibility prevents it from being broken. So the Gemara says a very interesting thing, that with a Bilam, even the bracha that he gives you carries the element of ultimate curse and downfall. And with a friend, Achia Shilomi, who loved the Jewish people, even the rebuke, even the Musar, carries with it a bracha. The Sephorno says, the secrets of a Jew surviving in Golos is to be like a kana, to be like a reed in which indeed we get buffeted and we get pushed around, so to speak, but that is the secret of our survival. So the Sephorno would be against, for example, notions of Jews demonstrating against Louis Farrakhan or the like. He says basically you try to keep a lower profile. And he gives a historical example. He says that during the Bayis Sheni, right, the destruction of the Second Temple in the hands of the Romans, if you remember, if you learn this on Tisha B'Av, this is the Gemara in Gittin that a lot of people learn, if you remember, most of the Chachamim were not in favor of waging war against Rome. They thought it was a suicide mission. The Roman Empire was so huge, they felt the Jewish people didn't have a particular amount of chesed because of sinas chinam, hatred and the like. So the Chachamim, although we're not pacifists at all, we wage war. I mean, the Torah does say there are times to wage war, but the Chachamim counseled that under those historical circumstances, it was proper to make shalom. Now, if you remember, there were a number of Jews who were called zealots, bar yonim, who felt that we have to force an armed struggle. And ad kedei kach, they went so far that they destroyed the food and water supplies of the Jews in Yerushalayim to force them to have to engage in armed struggle just to survive. And remember the whole story that Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai's own nephew was one of the zealots, and Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai wanted to make peace with the emperor, and his nephew said, well, I can't let you go, and he had to play dead, and he was carried out of the city in a coffin, and then he went to the emperor, the general who was going to become the emperor, and he pleaded, and he didn't ask for Yerushalayim because he thought he couldn't get it, but he pleaded for Yavne as an enclave where the Chachamim could go. And the Gemara says he should have asked for Yerushalayim, but then the Gemara says his position was if he asks for too much, he'll get nothing at all. But the Sephorno points out that it was the Bar Yonim Shebanu, it was the zealots among us, that resulted in the Churban of the Bayis Sheni. So on one hand, we have the Ramban, who seems to suggest that the ideal, see, both of them seem to reject confrontation, because Ramban is also not a confrontation. But the Ramban says, just don't get involved, kind of go off in your own way and don't get involved. Then we have the Sephorno, who seems to talk about the importance of positively contributing to the society, getting involved, but in a non-confrontational way. Of course, one could say, each one is, the answer is that there are times that when one derech is correct, the other derech is correct. For example, historically, the Ramban lived in the 12th century, was in Catholic Spain, where the Ramban was very well aware that it was dangerous to get too involved, because there were, the Inquisition wasn't then, but basically there were still many Inquisitions that were constantly going on, and the Ramban says the lower profile we keep, the better. The Sephorno lived in the Italian Renaissance in the 1400s, and in fact the Sephorno, it's a shadow of halacha, how could he do it? He was a gadol b'Torah, but the Sephorno gave Bible classes, taught Torah to cardinals in the Catholic Church. It's a question how you could do it, that's another question, but it is recorded that in fact he was doing it for the benefit of the Jewish people, etc. And indeed, many of the cardinals that he taught became Ohavei Yisrael, became lovers of Jews, and protected the Jews. So the Sephorno sees in his own life that their interaction can be a positive thing. The Ramban's experiences tended to be the opposite. As you know, towards the end of the Ramban's life, he was forced to have a public disputation. You know, and in a way, the way these public disputations with Catholic priests or renegade Jews worked in the Middle Ages was you lost no matter what happened. You know, it reminds me of the Salem witch trials. One of the ways they would determine if somebody was a witch is they would tie a weights to somebody, throw them into the water. If they sank and drowned, that shows they were innocent. If they floated, they must be witches, so they would be burnt at the stake. So it's kind of whatever happens, right? Whatever happens, you didn't win. Well, the same thing. If the Jewish defender was not a great Talmud Chacham, you know, so the Torah would be you know, embarrassed. If you had someone like the Ramban, who of course demolished the other side's point, the Ramban was ordered to leave Spain. He was, Mishnah says, good news and bad news, you've won, you got to leave. Now, of course, it turned out to be a bracha, because that is why the Ramban made Aliyah. The Ramban undertook the very difficult, arduous journey of going to Eretz Yisrael. He died in Eretz Yisrael. He wrote his Perush al Torah in Eretz Yisrael. And he basically was the, I mean, there were very, 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 very few Jews. He writes in one of his letters, just an amazing thing. He comes to Eretz Yisrael, which was under Ottoman, not Ottoman rule, but the predecessor of the Ottomans in Eretz Yisrael. And he writes that there was not a minion of Jews in Yerushalayim. And there was not a Sefer Torah to be found. There were 8 Jews in Hebron and 3 Jews in Yerushalayim, and they had a Sefer Torah in Hebron. And the Ramban says the point, Kol HaMakudish Mechaveira, the holier the place, the more desolate the place. Yerushalayim was more desolate than anywhere else, the Harabayas, etc. So, and Beis HaKnesses of the Ramban is still the oldest shul in Yerushalayim that's been in continuous use. So each is speaking of their own experience, because the answer is that depending on the society, sometimes we embrace, sometimes we have a low profile. The Kli Yoker also talks about this, B'derech Remez, it's a drush, and one of the psukim in Devarim, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Bnei Yisrael, Panu Lachem Tzafona, go north, in terms of traveling, go north, but Tzafon, or Tzafun, is also a word that means hidden or concealed, that keep a low profile. Indeed, it's interesting that the Kli Yoker made the observation, I'm thinking now, because the Kli Yoker was the Rav in Prague in the time of the Maral, the 1500s, the 16th century. And Prague actually had laws, they had very strict laws about not wearing expensive clothing and jewelry. And part of that was not to arouse the jealousy of the non-Jewish populations, which would then turn it against the Jewish people. Again, some people talk about whether this applies in America, where this type of attitude does apply. Many would say it should apply even here, that Jews in Galus do not necessarily expect to be able to say whatever they want to whomever they want, and one has to recognize that we have to create our own environments. But the point that I'm making is that you do see that the Rishonim themselves differed over whether the appropriate response is non-intervention and removal, or to kind of actively solicit goodwill. Chazal themselves speak about it in different ways. I mean, usually the Machlokas Rishonim can be traced to divergent Midrashim and the like. There's a well-known Chazal that say that Yaakov calling Esav Adoni and referring to himself as Avdecha for 8 times is the reason why the end of the Parsha says there were 8 generations of kings among Edom and Esav before there was a Melech b'Yisrael. That if you acknowledge Esav as your master X number of times, then they will have Malchus before you will have Malchus X number of times. We also know there's another statement in Chazal that say that because all of the Shvatim bowed down to Esav except for Yosef, and Binyamin was not born till after the encounter, because of this, Amalek, which is the grandchild of Esav, can only be defeated by the children of Rachel and not the children of Leah. The children of Leah have no koach over Amalek because they acknowledged Esav as their master. So Chazal see a tremendous negative symbol in this notion of obedience. By the way, just as a little digression, the Mefarshim give other reasons why the koach of Amalek can only be defeated by Zerah Rachel and not Zerah Leah. First of all, you understand that this is a pattern that permeates throughout the Tanakh and the Yosef Lavo as well. In the Midbar, when Amalek first attacked us, you recall that Moshe Rabbeinu did not lead the battle. Moshe Rabbeinu prayed, he went up on the mountain, he raised his arms, but the person who led the battle was Yehoshua ben Nun. This is Yehoshua's first appearance in the Torah. And he was called Hoshea ben Nun then. And Yehoshua, of course, is from Shevet Ephraim, which is from Zerah Yosef, right? The children of Yosef, Zerah Rachel. And then later, we find that there had to be a Malchus Shaul, right? That although Malchus belongs to Shevet Yehuda, but the first Melech is Shaul from Binyamin. Why? So all the Rishonim have the problem, really. What is the concept of Malchus Shaul? Why is there a Malchus Shaul? I mean, why is there a transitional Malchus? So the Rambam says, Maimonides says, because the Jewish people didn't ask for a king in the right way and for the right reason. Right? They wanted a king to be Kechol HaGoyim. They didn't like the spiritual leadership of Shmuel. So the Rambam makes the point that if you ask for a Melech for the improper motivation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will not give you a Malchus that will last. Meaning the Rambam says, Malchus Shaul was designed to be temporary and ephemeral and replaceable. Because we're not ready. We didn't deserve the real thing. Of course, you could ask a kasha on that, because it seems to be contradicted by the verses in Shmuel, because it seems to be that had Shaul carried out his job to destroy Amalek, the Malchus would have gone to him and his children. But that seems to contradict the idea that Yaakov's blessing was Malchus belongs to Yehuda. Right, so the Rambam himself and Ramban say, well, what would have happened is that somehow Shaul's successors would have had a secondary role. In other words, Malchus always would have gone to David, but Shaul's children would have been the prime ministers, or they would have been a vice president or some type of arrangement. Actually, I once raised this question, and one of the people there suggested an answer, that David really married Shaul's daughter Michal. And Michal didn't have any children for various reasons, but perhaps if Shaul would have been Zaycha, David would have had children from Michal Bas Shaul. So in effect, the monarchy would have come from David on the father's side, and through Shaul from Michal, which is a possibility.
Shaul is from Ephraim?
Shaul's from Binyamin, yes. But it's also Zerah Rachel. Yes, it does say. It says, Michal Bas Shaul did not have a child ad yom Mosa. So there is a drasha in Chazal. It's not Beferish in the
Pesukim.
Yeah, it does, but the Pesukim Divrei Yamim are susceptible to many interpretations. Everybody, you know, sometimes it means she raised a child. Very often when it says she had a child, it refers to her raising someone else's children. So it's not Beferish, but there is a Medrash that says she had a child, but there was a daughter. It was a daughter, yeah. So it wasn't the could have been a boy. It could have been, you know, a Malchus, etc. But that's what the Rambam says. But the reason that other Rishonim give why there was Malchus Shaul is that before there could be Malchus Beis David, there has to be Mechias Amalek, eradication of Amalek. The evil must be removed. Amalek prevents the kingdom of Hashem from being realized in this world. Right, what does the Torah describe Amalek? Ki yad al kes ka. Amalek's hand is on the throne of God. And it says kes without the aleph, because the kisei of Hashem, the malchus of Hashem, is not complete in this world. But in order to destroy Amalek, you have to have Malchus Shaul. And yet we have to have Zerah Rachel. And therefore, the whole purpose of Malchus Shaul was to eradicate Amalek and paved the way for the ultimate Malchus Beis David. And because Shaul did not carry out that mission, the Malchus Beis David was in itself never perfect. In other words, it could have been Mashiach, it could have been a final Geula, but Amalek wasn't eradicated. And that is why we find throughout the reign of David HaMelech, there were Amalekim in Eretz Yisrael, that when you didn't have a Zerah Rachel in charge, Amalek couldn't be destroyed. And of course the Purim story, where Esther and Mordechai are from the tribe of Binyamin, they are the ones who are instrumental in the downfall of Haman, who is from Agag. Agag is the surviving king of Amalek that Shmuel had to kill because he impregnated somebody in the middle, and that became the ancestor of Haman. Similarly, at the end of days, we have the enigmatic Mashiach ben Yosef, who precedes Mashiach ben David. actually, we know relatively little about Mashiach ben David. We know even less about Mashiach ben Yosef. But according to Midrashim, the Mashiach ben Yosef is some redeemer from Ephraim or Manasseh, who will destroy the evil in the world, will be Moche Amalek, paving the way for Mashiach ben David. Now, again, it's interesting to speculate that if we had to identify any force in this century that was the power of Amalek, it would certainly be Nazi Germany. And it's important to realize this, that a Nazi Germany is fundamentally different than even than the enemies that oppress the Jewish people today. You have Hamas and PLO and Arab, because basically they want land. See, the mark of Amalek, the Torah says, is Amalek acted out of pure hatred for the Jewish people and the Torah. They attacked us in the desert. We didn't have lands. We didn't have anything. See, an enemy, the Torah is differentiating between the enemy that attacks you because they want something from you, which is one type of enemy, indeed, an evil enemy, and the enemy that attacks you out of pure hatred. Again, I'm not condoning terrorism. I mean, Chas v'Shalom. But the point is, if a terrorist is attacking you because they want something, that's not yet Amalek. Amalek is an evil that is deeper than that. The one who doesn't want anything from you but to destroy you. That, of course, was what the Holocaust was. And that's why we identify Hitler and the like as Amalek, either genealogically, which some say, or at least spiritually. The spiritual tumma of Amalek was embodied in that society. So perhaps the Mashiach ben Yosef, who will not necessarily be revealed, may have been somebody who was fighting against the Amalek. That may have been. We don't know. That may have been the Mashiach ben Yosef, whoever, you know, a Jewish person who contributed towards that destruction. But the point, going back to the main point, you see from this a pattern in Chazal that Amalek can be defeated only by Rachel's children and not Leah's children. And one of the reasons that is offered in Chazal is because all the other Shvatim were Kofa. They had a submission towards the Koach of Esav, and only Bnei Yosef and Binyamin, who Binyamin wasn't born yet, are able to overcome. The other reason the Meshech Chachma says is that all of the brothers have an Achilles heel. What is Esav's one spiritual merit? See, even evil can only get its power from some aspect of good that is in it. There has to be a schus, in other words. Otherwise, it's not connected to Ribono Shel Olam, it can't exist. So, of course, what is the one schus that Esav has? Esav is the grandfather of Amalek. We know, of course, it's Kibud Aviyev. It's the honor that Esav showed Yitzchak. You could argue, and the Midrashim argue, whether that was a sincere thing or an insincere thing. It's a machlokas. I don't know if we have to begrudge Esav that one mitzvah. But even if it was insincere, Chazal look at Esav as an example of somebody who at least externally treated Yitzchak very well. All of the Shvatim who participated in Mechiras Yosef and brought such suffering to their father, therefore have a weakening, have a pagam in their kibud aviyim. And therefore that's the Achilles heel of us, and that is why Esav has that koach. The only two brothers who in effect did not participate in Mechiras Yosef as perpetrators is Yosef, who was the victim, and Binyamin, who wasn't born, and consequently, therefore, the Koach of Esav, which comes from his Kibud Aviyim over our lack of Kibud Aviyim, cannot be held against Yosef and Binyamin. But again, going back to the main point, I'm just bringing all this in to show you that the notion of the Shvatim bowing down to Esav elicits a tremendous condemnation in Chazal as somehow giving Esav that koach over us. And yet, just as we have the machlokas between Ramban and Sephorno, do you reach out or separate, there's a statement in the Gemara that when Rav Yehuda Hanasi, the author of the Mishnah, used to send letters to the Roman government to negotiate about things that the Jewish people needed, he would always say, Me'avdecha Yehuda, from your servant Yehuda, to my master the emperor. And he says, I'm following the example of Yaakov, our forefather. So What's interesting is that you see these divergent approaches to how to live in Golus, and of course Yaakov himself is embodying divergent approaches, right? Yaakov is Dolam, reaching out, Milchama, he's ready for both. Because since Maisa Ava Simin Labanim, see this is the problem, Maisa Ava Simin Labanim means that Yaakov has to encapsulate in his existence all the possible responses that Jews need in Golus, and therefore he does two contradictory things.
The key is adaptability.
Huh? Understanding the situation, and that's why tefillah is very, very crucial. I just don't know what I mentioned, I mentioned Rav Meir Shapiro visiting and saying American Jews, let me tell you the story quickly if you didn't hear. In the 1920s or early 30s, maybe before the Holocaust, before Hitler, Rav Meir Shapiro, he was the Rosh Yeshiva, the founder of the Lublina Yeshiva, the originator of Daf Yomi, very, very great Chashuv Rav. He died tragically at that 48, but really one of the great Rabbanim of Poland, came to America on a fundraising mission. And during that time it was proposed that there be a rabbinic exchange program where Poland would send some rabbis to America and America would send some rabbis to be Rabbanim a year in Poland. So Rav Meir Shapiro only liked half of the idea. He said, well listen, we're happy to send our Rabbanim to you, but please don't send your Rabbanim to us. And the truth of the matter is, it wouldn't have been a very good shidduch. First of all, the number of Polish Rabbanim who spoke English was absolutely minimal. I mean, English was not a common language there. And the level of Torah learning was of such an absolute... I mean, basically, Rav Moshe Feinstein used to remark that, in Poland or Russia, to know all of Shas and Shulchan Aruch was the basic requirement to get a position in a little village somewhere. I mean, you couldn't become the Rav of a 10-person family, town, unless you knew Shas and Shulchan Aruch. In America, you're a Gadol Hador, Shas and Shulchan Aruch. So he was saying a modesty on himself, just because Shas, it's not a big accomplishment. Every Rav in Europe was expected to know Shas. That was the minimum educational requirement. But Rav Meir Shapiro was asked at one point what his impressions of American Jews were. And he had a positive impression, because he saw, that's the Orthodox community was very, very small, but you had things like Young Israel, things were starting, and there were certain, Irving Vernon, other people who were really trying to stay firm, even though there were no yeshivas or anything. And he said that Americans had a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of passion, a lot of excitement. They would be committed to things. So he said, Americans are very good at making Kiddush, but they're not so good at making Havdalah. Meaning, they're very anxious and eager to embrace things that seem good and exciting, but they don't have a sense of where to draw the line and what to reject and what to accept. They're good at Kiddush, but not good at Havdalah. And the truth is, Havdalah, knowing what to separate, is a very difficult exercise. We know that the bracha of Motzei Shabbos, right? When you daven Maariv Motzei Shabbos, you have a bracha of Havdalah. And in which bracha of Shmona Esrei is the bracha of Havdalah? The fourth blessing of Shmona Esrei. Now the fourth blessing of Shmona Esrei is the blessing of Das, asking Hashem for knowledge and understanding. And the Gemara says, why is Havdalah in the fourth blessing? So the Gemara says, Imein Das, without Das, Havdalah minayin. How are you going to know to separate? And Das, as you know, is much more than, knowledge is a very inadequate translation for what Das is. Das is not information. Das is a deep intuitive understanding of the meaning of things. When we talk about Adam Yada Eschava Ishto, we talk about knowledge in the biblical sense. It doesn't mean physical relation, but it means knowing the other person to the depths of their emotional essence. So the das of any situation is the synthesis of the intellectual and the emotional, and seeing the patterns in things. It's a very, very deep level. There's chachma bina, and then there's das. So in effect, therefore, the challenge of the Jew in Golus, see, symbolically, when Yaakov, sends gifts, wages war, and prays, you can look at it two ways. When it talks about war, he's not just talking about armed conflict, but in effect, it's positing the dilemma of a Jew in Dulles. What do you accept of the culture out there, and what do you reject of the culture out there? You see, Dolron is the gesture of welcoming and bringing in. In fact, the Shorish of Dolron, which is gift, is related to Dira, making a home for. When I give you a gift, I'm, as it were, extending my home outward to embrace you. It's an act of embrace. Melchama is the ultimate act of rejection. So the dilemma that Yaakov is facing is not merely the dilemma, you know, do I take out my gun and fight, or do I make peace, but it's the concept of what do I embrace in the world and what do I expel in the world. And we know that extremities are always easier to live with. A person could take a position that everything out there, everything that is not within the Dalet Amais of Halacha, is totally treif, totally forbidden, and I will not allow it in. Or you could take the other position, which a Shomer Mitzvah normally does not take, is that, you know, everything out there is wonderful, and I will participate to the fullest of my abilities. It could be that what Yaakov Avinu is teaching us is not that a Jew should be either a Dolron or a Milchama person, but rather, indeed, you have to embody in your own life the notion of balance. I mean, let me give you a simple example. And nobody's going to say that, you know, we shouldn't use telephones. This is an obvious example, I guess, because they were invented by a Christian who's, you know, might be an Oved Avodah Zarah, right? In other words, certainly we recognize that at least in the technological areas, and even that with the internet there are all sorts of questions, but in a general proposition, we recognize that science and technology can certainly be incorporated into our lives and enhance Yiddishkeit, enhance, right, to have dial-a-dot or dial-a-share, telecommunications, etc. The question, which is very, very tricky, which I'm not going to answer because different Rabbanim and different, there are many, many different shitas, is when we go beyond the mechanical and the scientific, to what degree do we embrace a Chachma Bagayim Tamin, that there is Chachma Bagayim, or to what degrees do we say that we cannot allow it in? But there is indeed a balance, Dolron and Milchama, which is a very, very difficult balance, and the balance is more difficult in a free society than it is in an oppressive society. That's why it is said it's easier to be a Shomer Torah in Siberia than in suburbia. Because when there is total rejection from the outside, then it's much easier to remain a Maimon in some ways than when all of the options of life are open. In fact, it is said, many people disagree, but in the Napoleonic, the famous Napoleonic Wars against Russia. Now, the Jews in Russia at that time were living under very, very difficult and oppressive conditions under the Tsar. Tsar Alexander, I don't remember which number he was, but this was really the height of the anti-Semitic repressive regime, where kids were taken into the army sometimes at 12, and they were there for 30 years, and, you know, just awful, awful, awful. Now, Napoleon, in all of the lands under his control, Jews were given full civil rights. They had full rights to do anything. And many, many of the Hasidic Rabbanim in particular viewed the Napoleonic struggles with Russia as the wars of Gog and Magog that would be a precursor to Moshiach. It was a very symbolic. And most of the Rabbanim were hoping that Napoleon would be victorious over Russia, because that would mean a lot of more freedom for the Jews and less oppression. But the Baal HaTanya, the Elder Rebbe, actually was mispalel that Napoleon should lose, because he said that he preferred, again, we can't judge the situation, but he said he actually preferred the repression. He said that would keep the Jews connected to Kodesh Baruch Hu. Now, the emes is, however you come on the political issue, the emes is it's very, very true that the rise of the creation of the Reform movement is a direct result, historically, of the emancipation of Jews as a result of Napoleon, and earlier than that, the French Revolution, which was a little earlier. Indeed, we do see in our own modern history that freedom is very, very blessed, and freedom is something we appreciate, but it did have a tremendous cost in the religious life of the Jewish people. I'm not saying we should ask, you know, for repression and oppression and everything else, but these things do have a cost. These are not unbridled blessings.
But, you know, happy to
Things were not necessarily that good. I mean, there were many who considered many Jews in Spain to be not particularly observant. I mean, we had, of course, great Gedolim. There were great Gedolim pockets.
Yeah, yeah.
But the average population was not necessarily on spiritually such a high level.
And when it came to the end,
many became Maranas, yes. As opposed, for example, to the Jews in Germany during the Crusades, where people gave up their life very willingly. Now, again, I want to just emphasize, Chas v'Shalom, we should never stand in judgment on the Maranos, because none of us knows if we would have the Mesiras Nefesh to give up our lives. And in fact, the Rambam, regarding a much earlier persecution, is very, very emphatic that those who did not give up their life but converted because they were in fear of their lives but continued to keep the mitzvahs in private are considered to be Jews. They violated the halakha, yes, they did not keep the halakha of giving up your life, but they are to be welcomed back and embraced. And because somebody was saying you can't count them for a minyan because they converted to Christianity, and the Rambam said that's a tremendous avera to reject a Jew who couldn't make this ultimate sacrifice, because how many of us necessarily could?
I think in America it's hard for us to fathom that, because our experience is the opposite. In fact, you see, in this day and age, you see people who have had total exposure to freedom making their way back to observance, not even just in the Jewish community, even in the Gentile community.
Yeah.
Because, whereas in all the other experiences you're talking about, you're talking about people who are totally oppressed, and when they had an opportunity, they just like went to the other extreme.
Right. I think you have a point. I think the point is that when you have freedom for a long enough period, you begin to feel its limitations, you begin to see that it doesn't really give you a meaning in your life, and then you move back. In other words, you're right, it was the short-term freedom that was always the most dangerous for the Jew, because the freedom that is followed by the repression would just explode outwards. And that happened in America too, when immigrants came here, etc. You're correct, over a prolonged period of time, the excitement and the dazzle of the freedom begins to wear off. And in fact, sociologists of religion who mark mega trends, so to speak, actually point out that there are certain periods in the world where people, not just Jews, turn to God in some way or the other. Like 100 years ago, there was something like that, and it's like every 100 years. And they suggest that based on what they see this is one of the periods in the world where there's a great turn to religion. But you're right, I think that the phenomenon is that after a while, the materialism grates on you. You know, the first time you can do something, it's so exciting, but then you have to ask yourself, is that all there is? And that's what's happened to many people.
Not to be overly pessimistic, but I teach at a university in the area, and there are some of our children that are coming back to us, but there are much greater numbers that are not, and some get lost. Even before they
realize
that they want to come back.
Yeah. Somebody told me a statistic, this is just an amazing statistic, that 90% of converts to Buddhism from Western countries, 90%, 9 out of 10 are Jews. That if an American is converting, it'll be a Jewish person. Now, the truth is, you could look at that horrendously and say, oh, that's awful. But on the other hand, there's a tremendous promise that is implicit in that negative phenomenon. That is, these are people who are spiritual seekers. Now, they haven't been taught that Yiddishkeit has anything for them, because the Judaism they've been exposed to is either zero, or it's been very materialistic and non-spiritual. The emphasis is that these converts are potentially the best Jews that can be, because they're coming to for spirituality. And to the Dalai Lama's credit, he actually encourages them to go back to Judaism. But he says, listen, if they want to stay with me, I can't force them to go away. But he does in fact urge them to explore their heritage.
You said before that there are all these, Yaakov is acting in contradictory manners.
Yeah.
And it seems to be, are you suggesting that he was aware of the concept of Mike Elvis and Mabani? And if he was, then did you give us any indication as to when to choose what?
Yeah, the Rishonim, it's not clear. It's a very interesting question. When Chazal say, Maisa Avos Simin Labanim, does that connote a conscious awareness on the part of the Avos? The Midrashim are not very clear. The Rishonim seem to understand this as a conscious realization that they are establishing a people, and they are establishing a destiny, and therefore there is even this awareness that everything they do has this effect. You're correct. The Midrashim are not favorish on that, but that seems to be the way the Ramban understands the idea. What was Yaakov's insight when? It's hard to know when, and it's essentially it seems to be a function of tefillah, which is the third function. And tefillah is a very interesting word, very, very interesting word. Tefillah is the most common word we use for prayer. Now we know Chazal have identified 10 different lashonos of tefillah, the Eschanan and Rina, all of these are tefillah. But the shorish of tefillah is pei lamed lamed, palel. Now palel means to judge, to evaluate, to analyze a situation. Shoftim, judges, are called in the Torah polilim. In modern Hebrew, if you commit a crime, it's called avon polili, a sin for which you can be judged, you can be convicted. Now, the his palel is reflexive, right? Like the his rachetz is to wash yourself. So, lif palel is to judge another. Le his palel is to engage in self-introspection, self-evaluation, self-judgment. So, part of the idea of tefillah is not so much to be asking Hashem for things, but by coming in contact to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you undergo a self-transformation as to what in your life is significant and what in your life is important. In fact, that's what the Sefer Yikarim says, the famous Kasha, if Hashem knows what you want, what's the purpose of praying? I mean, Manashach, do you change Hashem's mind? Does God change? Is God changeable by human intervention? Certainly, the one thing prayer does not do is inform Hashem. You know, I can go to my mother and ask her for something because she may not know that I need it, but Hashem knows what I need. So what am I praying for? Is it buttering Hashem up? So the Sefer Yikarim says, the yisayit of tefillah is that through your submission to Hashem, you become transformed into a different type of person. And as a result, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hanhaga with you is different. In other words, if Hashem decreed that Reuven is not entitled to certain brachos, but now Reuven has become a different person, that different person is not Bichlal the Gezerah. Right? The same idea, in a way, that changing a name is a segula because Hashem decreed Reuven won't live, but Chayim Reuven is not Reuven. So the concept is every tefillah is a shinoi Hashem. In an ideal sense, we're not always zocha to it. But what we aspire to do is we aspire to change our personalities, to become transformed. And that's implicit in the very word, lehispala. So you have to see that even the shorish of the word shows us. So in effect, it makes a lot of sense why Chazal used tefillah as the third component. Because if the grappling is, what do I embrace, what do I reject, then lehispala, through the self-evaluation of prayer, I get a sense of what will hurt me and what will strengthen me. Remember we talked in Parshas Melech that Rav Flitner talks about two models of enclosures. There is the enclosure of the Ark, of the Teva, and there's the enclosure of the Mishkan. The Teva is that which keeps the outside world out. It's an excluder. The Mishkan radiates the light of the Shekhinah outwards to the entire world. So the question is, therefore, a Jewish home has to be a combination of the Teva and the Mishkan. There's actually a biological analogy. You know, the Pasuk says in Iyov, Mibsori Echaze Eloka. We have to see Hashem from our physical body. There are cells. Take a cell in the body. And there are cells which have a wall, right? There's a cell wall around them. And certain cell walls, actually all cell walls, if they're healthy, absorb nutrients. They are permeable for the good stuff, but they repel that which is no good. And there's the same wall, accepts certain things, rejects. So a Jewish neshama has to be a permeable cell wall, which can take the good. Now, you see, Chazal grapple with this. Chazal identify it as a problem. See, when you find midrashim that are contradictory, one way of approaching contradictory midrashim is not to even say there's a machlokas. In fact, in Agadah, we generally don't say there's a machlokas. We generally say the midrashim are reflecting, you know, a multitude of aspects of a situation, different facets, all of which are true, but all of which are totally true only if you consider all of them. So if you have these statements, or it's good to embrace, it's bad to embrace, we're not necessarily dealing with machlokas, but we're dealing with the complexity of living in this world. So the midrashim tell us, therefore, that you need that idea of tefillah to be able to make that differentiation. I'll give you another example of this dilemma that we face. If you remember, the one recorded heretic in Chazal, who was a great, great Talmud Chacham, is Elisha ben Avuya. Elisha ben Avuya apparently was such a... His defection is such a shock that we don't even call him by name. We commonly call him Acher, the other one. We don't even, you know, refer to him. Of course, as some want to say, Acher is a reflection of the fact that it's like another spirit possessed him. It's not his real self. In other words, some want to look at Acher as almost a compliment to him, saying, that's not the real person. He just got taken over by a demon of some sort, Acher. But if you remember, Rabbi Meir, the great Rabbi Meir, used to continue to learn from Acher, even after Acher became a heretic. I mean, the Gemara has a story that Acher was riding a horse on Yom Kippur, and Rabbi Meir was asking him shalas, and Acher told him, you can't walk any further because this is the 2,000 amos from your place. You don't go any further, I'll go. You know, I'll keep on riding my horse and everything else. And Rav Meir begs his Rebbe, why don't you do tshuva? And he says, I heard a voice from heaven saying, all can do tshuva except Acher. But of course, the Gemara explains, Acher could have done tshuva as well, but Hashem makes it a little harder for him because he knew so much and he moved away. But the Chachamim questioned Rav Meir, how can you learn Torah? Actually, it's an interesting analogy, by the way. The Gemara gives like two. The Gemara has Rav Meir say one of two mashalim. Look at this. Mashal number one is I throw away the peel and I eat the seed. Now there's the pomegranate. I throw away the and I eat the seed. And the other is I throw away the pit and I eat the fruits. It's an interesting idea because if the concept is I throw away the peel and I eat the seed, Rav Meir is saying that Acher inside is really good. He's like saying that my Rebbe still has this holiness within. If what he's saying is I eat the fruit and I throw away the pit, Rav Meir in effect is saying the inside is really all rotten, but there's still some good fruit on the outside. So there is a question if his judgment on the Rebbe is the Pnimius is good or the Chitzonius is good. But be it as it may, this issue is something we confront also. You know, you know, I'm sure you have this problem sometimes. You read a book by a certain author that may have some good ideas, but there's other things that are intermeshed. You go to a lecture, God, I'm not going to give any answers today, you have to ask your own Rabbanim. So on one hand, people say, well, look at Rav Meir. On the other hand, you know, I'll say, well, when you're Rav Meir, you can learn by Acher. You know, but that issue of you have to be on a certain madrega to do that.
Or, by that previously being an issue.
Yeah.
And I don't belong to two generations ago, but
right.
So I went to college. I went to Rav Shach, whether I could. Mm-hmm. What Rav Shach said?
The one that I remember
from
Benin,
you know,
right.
Translating for
Yiddish, right.
That generally for women, he would say, the less
tiflus
is better, but for you I
say yes. In other words, there were individual decisions.
Yeah.
See, that has been the approach. I mean, that's in a way, one of the chesronos we've seen in recent years is the concept of everything being rigidly established as a one-size-fit-all, when the tradition of Klal Yisrael has always been individual psak halacha. I mean, that's the appropriate thing. It's not something is totally usher for everybody, totally mutter for everybody. One has to make cheshbonos. And the Derech Klal, see, this is the problem. Derech Klal, a gadol always answers a shiloh that way. When people are not gadolim, so we don't have the capacity, so we have to make rules. But a rule is what a person does when they don't have the insight to deal with the individual dynamics of a situation. But again, I'm pointing out questions, but these are the questions of what to accept, what to reject. The Shaila of Acher, and the Shaila is, can anybody in this generation even purport to be like Rav Meir in that sense? You know, it even goes Ad Kedei Kach. This is more of a mystical idea, but you know, many people would not listen, let's say, to Shlomo Kabach music. Now, one argument is, well, it's music. I mean, he's not giving a shir on hashkafa, but there's a concept, if someone's hashkafa is not totally correct, the music can affect you. Others say, you know, that's not him, it's not. But it's an issue that certainly we have to grapple with, and this, of course, is the great Nisayan of Hanukkah, just to go into Hanukkah, because we know that when Yaakov Avinu was mispalel, Hatzileini na miyad achi miyad Esav, save me from Esav, save me from my brother. So the Beis Halevi asks the Kasha, why does Yaakov say, save me from Esav, my brother? Esav is his only brother. So the Beis Halevi says that Yaakov is mispalel for two things. Save me from the Esav who wants to kill my body. But save me also from the Esav who may embrace me as a brother. Because if the Esav tries to kill my body, that's one thing. But if the Esav embraces me, that could destroy my neshama. And we know, of course, that this is the difference between Hanukkah and Purim. Purim was primarily a churban of the guf. Right? Our bodies were in danger. Haman was Hitler. In other words, Hitler didn't care if you were Jewish, or if you were firm or not firm. Indeed, as you know, there's a whole controversy in the Catholic Church. There was a young woman who died in Auschwitz, who was a Jew who converted, who became a nun. And she was sent to Auschwitz, and now the Catholic Church wants to canonize her, make her a saint, and the Jewish community says, oh, no, you're taking a Jewish person and making her a saint. So Hitler didn't care, right? You could become a nun, and you'd go to Auschwitz. But then we have Hanukkah, which is a very, very different situation. With Hanukkah, as you know, Antiochus and the Yevanim were perfectly happy to let the Jews live in Eretz Yisrael. They could do whatever they wanted, but he wanted them to assimilate and adopt the customs of the non-Jewish world. In particular, we know that the targets were obliteration of Shabbos, Bris Milah, Rosh Chodesh, because Rosh Chodesh is the whole calendar, sanctifying Rosh Chodesh sets all the Yom Tovim. And as Alden Mefarshim point out, what the Yevanim wanted to do above all was to obliterate the sense that the Jewish people were unique and different. Become the same. Shabbos is the uniqueness that we can be Mekadesh, or that Zman. We are Mekadesh Zman. Bris Milah is the sanctification of the guf, of the body. Like the Greeks glorified the body, but they didn't believe that the body was under the control of God. The Bris Milah takes the most involuntary organ of a human being and in effect submits it to our Kodesh Baruch Hu. Rosh Chodesh is the koach of a Jew to sanctify one. See, Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh are opposites. Shabbos is time that is sanctified by Hashem. Rosh Chodesh is what we do. What we do. Remember what the Rambam says? It's very interesting. The Rambam says the only reason we have Yom Tovim today, because after all, Yom Tov depends. Pesach is the 15th day from Rosh Chodesh Nisan. If there's no basin to sanctify the new moon, there's no Yom Tov. The last basin that did this sanctified all the calculated and sanctified all the Rosh Chodeshim in advance. And that is why it is said they did it till the year 6000. Which is why Mashiach can't come after 6000, because then we're not going to have a Pesach anymore. In other words, the Yom Tovim come from the holiness of Yisrael, right? Shabbos is the holiness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yom Tov comes from the holiness of Yisrael. That's why they On Shabbos we say Mekadesh Shabbos, and by Yom Tov we say Mekadesh Yisrael V'Hazmanim, because Yisrael, it's Kedusha, it's Mekadesh this month. So these three symbols, the holiness of time and the sanctification of the physical and the ability of the Jew to sanctify time, not just receive time from Hashem, all of these are Havdalos, all of these are separations. And the Yevanim don't want the separation. In fact, the Mefarshim of Adai Yishor says that when Yaakov is struggling with the angel, and the Pasuk says, Vayivaser Yaakov Levado, Yaakov is by himself. That's what it says. Rav Shor says that that is what the angel is attacking. The angel is attacking the Midah of Levado. Don't be a Levado. A Levado personality is a very interesting phenomenon. A person that's a Levado does not live his life. In fact, this is not just relevant to the Goyim, it's relevant to our own lives, even among religious Jews. You don't live your life based on the approval of the crowd or the disapproval of the crowd. A person does what's right because it's right, whether you get credit, whether it's appreciated, whether it's acknowledged. It's lo mayil of lo mayrid. A Levado, like the opposite of a politician, we would say, right? A politician, every single move depends on somebody approving and saying, you're great, you're wonderful, right? If you say something and somebody doesn't say you're great, so you change it the next day till you get that right, till you get the right remark. That's the opposite of Levado. And the koach that Yaakov Avinu exhibited is the capacity to be a Levado. That doesn't mean we're not interested in Kiddush Hashem and in people thinking well of us, because there is an inyan of to be a Naki, to be clean and high in the eyes of human beings as well. But ultimately, a person has to have an internal compass based on their connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah and with Chachmei HaTorah, that one does what's right even if it's not acknowledged. And this translates into many, many areas, this idea of Levado. You do chesed for your family even if it's not always going to be appreciated. It should be appreciated. That's a taina on whoever's not appreciating, indeed. But that doesn't stop you from doing what's right. In fact, indeed, if a person's a maimon, it's easier to have this habit. You know, if a person, chassam, didn't believe in a ribono shel olam, and a person is doing good things that nobody else notices, it would be hard to go on, because a person says, this is oblivion, this will, no one is noticing this, so it'll be totally forgotten. But the ribono shel olam doesn't forget. And therefore, a levado person who has emunah can do things that are not acknowledged, because one knows that a Kodesh Baruch Hu appreciates. The Gemara says at one point that Rav Shimon ben Yochai was very sad because whatever it was, he wasn't getting a certain cover that he felt he deserved. So Rabbi Akiva told him, who was his Rebbe, he says, Rav Shimon, it's enough that HaKadosh Baruch Hu and I know who you are. You know, you don't have to have the whole world know who you are. So Levade, which of course on one level is the what the Yevanim are trying to obliterate, and Yaakov is the Levado personality, that's the key to surviving in Golis, that the litmus test. And remember, the Chashmonaim were not just fighting the Yevanim, right? You have to know this. Historically, the Chashmonaim were fighting, not militarily, but spiritually, the great majority of the Jewish population. That's why Hanukkah is really very, very parallel to the United States. Not because we're fighting a war, there happens to have been a war as well, but because just like today, we may have 90%, 95% of the Jews who don't believe in Shabbos and don't believe in Kashrus and think intermarriage is okay. Right? That was somewhat of the situation in Eretz Yisrael then as well. But we mentioned that the Chazal say that the Golus of Yavin is called the Golus of Darkness. And the reason it's called the Golus of Darkness is because they were in Eretz Yisrael. They had a Beis HaMikdash. They had everything there. But they didn't see it. Darkness is when everything is there and you don't see it. The Maral says that the nature of Choshech is Golus of perception, not a Golus in reality. They were not in Golus, but they didn't see. They didn't see what was there. They turned to other things, and therefore is the light of Hanukkah is the korach that takes us out of the goals of perception. Again, you know, historically, the history is very, very interesting here. We know that Matisyahu and later his children led a war against the Yavanim, and they entered the Beis HaMikdash, which had been desecrated for 3 years. For 3 years, Chazalim and things were sacrificed in the Beis HaMikdash under Greek domination, and then finally we gained control of the Beis HaMikdash, and we found the oil, and the oil was only enough for one day, and it burned for 8 days. But people often think that that was the end. The truth is, the military struggle to gain control of Eretz Yisrael lasted for another 25 years. Meaning, Hanukkah was not the time that we gained control of Eretz Yisrael. You look at this, if you look at the book of the Maccabees, Sefer HaMaccabim, which is the post-biblical source for the Hanukkah story, the story of Hanukkah is in Perek Aleph. I mean, the whole book are the events that occurred afterwards. The specific dates, I can vaguely give you the dates. The Hanukkah story, it is said, the founding of the oil occurred in approximately the year 165 before the Common Era. The proclamation of Shimon, who was the last surviving son of Matisyahu, after all of them were killed, who was proclaimed as king of the Jewish people and established a separate state, was in approximately 140 before the Common Era. So this is 25 years of Milchamah. Now what that tells you is the following. It is incorrect, therefore, that Hanukkah celebrates a military struggle of independence. Hanukkah is not the 4th of July. Because if Hanukkah would have been the 4th of July, that wasn't what happened the 25th of Kislev. That happened years later and happened to be Cheshvan. We're given the date for that as well. It's not that. Hanukkah commemorates the finding of the Pach Shemen and the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash, those two things. The dedication of the Beis HaMikdash and the finding of a Pach Shemen, of a little bit of oil. But why is that important? I mean, why, you know, how is that relevant to us? The answer is that the Pach Shemen represents the koach of light to be miskaber, to defeat Choshech, even a little bit of light. Because you look at yourself and you look at the world and you say, what can I do as an individual? I'm powerless, I'm helpless. I have no way of protecting myself and my family from the onslaughts of this society, and I have no way of influencing that society. Well, you find one day of light, and you think, it's only one day, what's the use? Why should I light it today if tomorrow, in other words, a person cannot make new oil for another 8 days. So you find one day of oil. The Derech HaTeva, you look at that oil, in the natural, and you look at it and you say, well, like, what's the use of lighting it today? I'm not going to have it tomorrow. And yet you see from Hanukkah that if you do what you can do, you do the best you can, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates blessing in what we do, in which there's ripple effects. Now, it's interesting that secular historians identify both Hanukkah and Gehabo Christmas with the winter solstice. The winter solstice is the longest night of the year, the shortest day, and they say these are pagan festivals that celebrate, you know, these various turning points. So we look at that and we say, ah, because of this, that's not what we believe in. But it's interesting that the Maharal does indeed say that there's a reason why Hanukkah happens around the winter solstice. Because the winter solstice, the day is not exact, but it's approximate, is the time when the night is the longest and the darkest. But ironically, precisely at that time, the light begins to increase. So he says, it's hiskabra so'or al ha-choshech. So from appearances, you don't see it. You still see much more darkness than light. That's the thing. But ironically, at the point where there's the most darkness is when the light is beginning to increase. And therefore he says, that's the remnants of the Jew in Golos. That the Golos Yavan, and of course Golos Edom, although we're in Golos Edom today, but to some extent, as the Maharal himself says, Edom is not a distinct Golos. Edom is an amalgamation of all of the characteristics that exist in all Golios. Therefore, we in America are in the Yavan aspect of Galus Eden. In other words, you see, in other words, there is the Galus of persecution and annihilation, there's the Galus of Choshech. Galus Edo, which is a very long Galus, the Galus of Rome, is a challenge that encompasses facets of each of those Galuses. So we are in the Yavan branch of Galus Edo, the Galus of Choshech, and it's a long Galus, but precisely where the Choshech seems deepest is when the Or can continue to triumph. So Chanukah is a tremendous affirmation of bitachon and emuna, not only in our Kodesh Baruch Hu, and also in ourselves and our ability to be miskaber over this Choshech. And that's what we're celebrating. We're not celebrating the military victory, because historically, remember, the military victory, it was a victory, but it occurred 25 years later, and it wasn't on Chanukah. By the way, it's interesting, people ask the question, one of the famous questions of Chanukah, if there was enough oil to light for one day, and the miracle was it lasted for another 7 days, so we should only have Chanukah for 7 days. The first day is not a miracle. What's the miracle of the first day? So there are hundreds and hundreds of answers. This is one of the famous questions of the Beis Yosef. The simplest answer actually is that the original reason for the 8 days of Chanukah was because the Chanukah Beis HaMikdash, the word Chanukah comes from the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash, lasted 8 days, just as it lasted 8 days for the Mishkan. So the 8 days are Chanukah Habayis, not the miracle of the Pach HaShemen per se. Another answer that is often given is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to recognize that even nature is a miracle as well. In other words, what are you saying? You're saying, well, the first day was natural. It's only the extra days. But the concept of a nes, what does the Rabban say a nes means? A nes is a banner. A banner is designed to draw your attention to something. The Rabban says, the tachlis of a nes nigla, the purpose of a revealed miracle, is to teach us that everything in our life is a miracle. Right, the Gemara says in Tainus by Rav Chanina ben Dosa that one time his wife did not have any oil to light Shabbos candles, so he told her, put vinegar in the holder and light the vinegar. So vinegar doesn't light. She says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who says that oil can light, can also say vinegar can light. Meaning, he's saying, oil lighting is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's nes also. Life is a miracle. Everything is a miracle. So in Melech, the Chazal wants us to recognize the miracle in everyday life. Right? Shimon Esrei says it, Ani Secha Shebechol Yomi Mana. A miracle every day. So in fact that's what it means in the Noah Sur. It says, B'nei Bina, people of understanding, Yemei Shimona make Chanukah for 8 days. So why does it say B'nei Bina? Because what is Bina? Bina is to be Maven Davor Mitoch Davor. To understand one thing from another thing. A chacham learns what he sees. A maven goes beyond. If a chacham were to enact Chanukah, he would only make it for 7 days. A maven, whose maven davar mitoch davar, understands even the first day is an ace. B'nei bina yemei shimona, made Chanukah for 8 days. But this notion of the light overpowering the darkness is just a very, very significant. It gives a person a chizuk and strength to go on and to recognize that things that look hopeless can produce a lot of good if one keeps on trying. And Habal Attire, if we try to open up the gates, even if we're powerless, we think, HaKadosh Baruch Hu blesses our efforts. Let me just end with one quick thought from the Tzvas Yemes. If you look into Gemara, the Gemara has a very interesting machlokas between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Well-known Gemara. What is the proper way of celebrating Chanukah? Beis Shammai says you start off with 8 candles and you go down. And Beis Hillel, which is what we do, you start off with 1 and you add for every night. And the Gemara discusses different things. Beis Hillel says you go up in Kedusha. Beis Shammai says we compare this to the korbanos of Sukkos. It says, Sukkot, you bring bulls every day. The first day you bring 13, then you go down to 12, etc. It adds up to 70, by the way. That's what you get. Sukkot, you bring korbanos for the 70 nations of the world. So first of all, what exactly is Beis Shammai's point in all of a sudden bringing in the Sukkos Korbanos, etc., and what's the Machlokas Bechlau? What is the argument here? So first, as a historical note, let me just point out, if you look at the Book of the Maccabees, the Sefer HaMaccabim, you do see that to some degree the Chachamim had in mind when they were Misakin a holiday of Hanukkah that it should be a replacement for Sukkot. Now, well, for that year they didn't have Sukkot, or they didn't celebrate Sukkot in the Beis HaMikdash because the Beis HaMikdash was under foreign control. The Greeks had control of the temple for 3 years, and they were in the Misakin at the first opportunity to have an 8-day holiday similar to the 8 days, you know, Sukkot and Shemini Atzeres. And it's recorded that for a few years, this was not a permanent takana, but for a few years, they even took Lulav and Esrog on Chanukah, because it was treated as a temporary makeup, not really, but just as a zecher, as a commemoration for Sukkot, which is yet another answer why Chanukah is 8 days, because you correlate it to that. But that did, and that could be obliquely why Beis Shammai connects the Hadlakas Hanelos to the progression of the Sukkot Korbanos. But it's very oblique. Beis Shammai does not cite the Sefer HaMaccabim, but again, there may be a connection there. But the Sfas Emes says there's a spiritual explanation for this. And he says, when you light the candles of Chanukah, you're also lighting a candle for your neshama. We know neshama is called the light of Hashem. Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam, right? The menorah has many rumors. Torah is called light, but the neshama is called ner. Right? So the light ignites the neshama, as it were. In fact, even the word nefesh, soul, is an acronym for ner. Ner is the receptacle, where the candle, psila, the wick, shemen, the oil. And the or of Hashem lights the oil, ignites the soul. So lights or fire has two symbolisms. Lights or heat or fire can destroy and consume, and fire can give warmth and illumination. Beis Shammai says that the imagery of fire is that which destroys the evil in the world. So Chanukah represents the hisgabrus, the strengthening of the fire which destroys the evil and burns it up. So in Beis Shammai's vision, gradually the need for that fire is going to diminish as time goes by. The first day, you have 8 things of evil to eradicate. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. Then you're down to 0. Therefore, it's symbolic of the progressive diminution, the diminishing of the kochos of evil in the world. And that's why it's connected to Sukkot. Because the Korbanos connected to Shivim Umos is designed to diminish their powers of evil as we progress towards Mashiach. And Beis Shammai says, so too in the individual Avodas Hashem, a person becomes close to Hashem as they concentrate on their flaws and they systematically try to rectify them and eradicate them. And therefore the Avoda is to be a poches v'holech. You go down. Beis Hillel says that's not going to work for many people, because as we focus on that which is negative within us and we try to deal with it, we'll often get caught up in that negativity. It'll drag us down. It'll make us depressed. It'll take away our hope. So Beis Hillel says, instead of using the fire to burn away that which is bad within you, use the fire as light and warmth to work and grow in that which is already good within you and strengthen it. And the light will get rid of the darkness, not by directly attacking the darkness, but the light drives away the darkness automatically. And therefore, in Beis Hillel's metaphor of light, you add, because he's not perceiving of the fire as the fire which is machariv, but the or, the light which is masakin. And therefore, these are two derachim in Avodas Hashem, the Sfas Emes says. One is called Sur Meira, from the Pesach. Turn away from evil, which is a poches v'holech, because hopefully there's less and less evil as you go on. Or Asei Tov, which hopefully you increase as you go on. Now, the Emes is, we know that normally the halach is like Beis Hillel, but the Ari says, Le'olam Habor, the halach is like Beis Shammai, meaning Beis Shammai is objectively correct. Objectively, a person has to have the strength of character
to look at their problems and get rid of them. But Beis Hillel's view is said to be a more Midas HaRachamim view for the weaker natures of people. And Beis Hillel recognizes that psychologically we are often not strong enough to focus on that part of our personality. So Beis Hillel basically says, don't focus on it. Don't be obsessed with it. Work on that which is good within you. And as that strengthens you inside, the evil thing will get diminished a little bit at a time as well. So there is, even in Beis Hillel's view, a poches v'holech, but you're not directly concentrating on it. The poches v'holech is the consequence of the mosif v'holech, of the additional of the life. So hopefully all of you have a pleasant Hanukkah, for the Hanukkah. We'll see you next week.
Next week?
It would have to be next week, but I won't be able to
do that.
Next week. I think so.
That's good for me because I've got to do it. This is the last part.
I'm not the last week. Can I borrow it and make a copy? Yeah, you didn't come last week?
I missed 4 weeks. I missed that. I didn't know that it was.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask Rachel, but I'm trying to get last week. Someone told me that it was not for my. It was my birthday.
Yeah, what was it? Like 30
cents? Yeah.
Right.
You know, that table. I should finish it. No, I don't have it with me. You want to pick it up? Okay. 3810 Menlo.
Oh, I'm going right now.
I'm going right down Menlo to pick up my daughter.
Oh, all right. So, okay.
You know, if you let your humility subvert your submission to the Ribbono Shel Olam.
But was it really humility? Like I always thought of it as being like he wanted everybody to like him too much, and he was more affected by other people's opinions, and that's not a characteristic of a leader.
That's right, and that may be the downside of humility. In other words, the downside, the negative aspect of humility, is that one does not have a strong sense of one's ultimate inner core.
It's more like low self-esteem and real humility.
Okay, again, we can't fully psychoanalyze this, but
right.
But that's, in other words, Shaul was clearly subject to pressures from the outside, as opposed to having that leadership which he could project.
And you see that same characteristic continues, like as David becomes more well-liked, or people start to notice him, he becomes like consumed with jealousy. And so it's the same characteristic. He's like in competition. Like you were saying before, he's not the kind of person who can feel happy when somebody else is getting recognition.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to say one thing about Shaul, that, you know, indeed, you know, Shaul is considered to be Mashiach Hashem, he's the anointed of Hashem, and, you know, very, very great beyond our estimation, but in terms of what the facets that we can perceive that, that there was obviously a chisol in there, in that way. So it may have been the negative side, it may be the dark side of humility. The dark side of humility, in other words, David's humility can allow him to assert and do what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants, even if it's unpopular. Shaul's unnava did not allow him to make that step. Now, the other reason that's given why Shaul is not given a second chance is not because Shaul's sin is worse than David's sin, which is what the Sefer Yikarim says, but rather the difference is how do they respond. When Shaul is confronted with the Aveira, so Shaul's idea is to pass the buck. Shaul does it a few times. First of all, Shaul denies it. Shaul says, what do you mean? I took care of all the sheep. I killed everybody. Not the sheep, but I took care of all the Amalekim. And then Shmuel says, what about the sheep? Oh, the sheep. The sheep is for Korbanos. And what about Agag? He says, oh, well, the people, you know, I was worried about the people. And there's a constant notion of either diverting attention from it, denying it, trying to paint it in good pictures, and if that doesn't work, blaming somebody else. When Nasan HaNavi goes into David and confronts David, you know, the famous mashal, the famous parable about the poor man and the rich man, and the poor man had only one little sheep, and the rich man took the sheep and killed it and ate it. What should happen to this rich man? And David says, such a person deserves to die. And Nasan mm-hmm. says to him, Atah Ish, you are the man. You are the man. And there's only one word, David says, Chatasi, I have sinned. There is no excuse. There is no blame. There is no notion, somebody made me do it. There is no taina. He could have said, for example, well, why is Bathsheba, you know, doing it? Nowhere I can see, you know. He could have said something. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't say anything. And even the killing of Uriah Hachiti was halachically justified, right? Because Uriah, we are told, was sent to the front, but he had disobeyed a royal order. He was a Mori B'malchus. Bathsheba had a get. David could have come up with all the excuses in the world. But he realized that in Hashem's eyes, he didn't have an excuse. And he accepted it. And this midah of owning up to failure is exactly the midah that was exemplified in Yehuda. That when Tamar doesn't want to give away Yehuda's identity. She says, the man who gave me these things, and the Gemara makes the point that if Yehuda wouldn't have admitted, she would have been executed, she would have been burnt. And from here the Gemara derives the principle, it is better to better to throw yourself into a fire before you humiliate somebody. And Yehuda says, Sadka mimeni, she is more righteous than I. So this concept of the capacity that Yehuda also comes, again, although the Torah indicates Leah called her son Yehuda because of gratitude, but Yehuda also comes from the word to be moda, to confess, to acknowledge. And that goes back to another, that's another facet of anava, true anava, is the willingness to acknowledge the mistake and to take responsibility for the mistake and not to blame others and not to think. Because all of us in our lives, we have an infinite number of people that we can blame all sorts of things for. But the ultimate test of a melech is the one. Harry Truman said the buck stops here. That's the concept that you have to assume the responsibility. Because what was Nixon's line? He takes the responsibility, not the blame. Yeah.
Why then does it say, I guess it's in the Gemara, that a woman is not happy until she has a son, because then she has someone to blame the broken pot, you know, but blame.
Yeah, I don't remember that, because I'm going to say Chazal. I don't remember that, but that's very... Uh-huh. So why Rachel wanted to do Dayim, so she'd have somebody to blame for the pot. Well, you know, it's human nature. You know, it's human nature. We all, we all do that. But nevertheless, the ultimate malchus is not to do that. The ultimate malchus is to recognize your responsibility. So that's the other idea. Now, let me just mention, backtrack a second about Yehuda. So one aspect of Yehuda, and this was Nishrash. This was a midah that was Nishrash in Yehuda, and in Malchus based on it, the concept of recognizing mistake, recognizing error. We even see it by Mechiras Yosef. You know, when you know, Yehuda was the one that originally, Yehuda was the one who had the idea to sell Yosef, and the other brothers wanted to kill him. But, you know, Yehuda, L'chol HaPachah, said, let's sell him instead, right? Reuben said, throw him in the pit, because Reuben wanted to retrieve him later. Yehuda didn't know what Reuben's thought was. Yehuda said, let's sell him instead of spilling his blood. But you see that later it's Yehuda that's willing to say, in effect, that I will give my life, he tells the Yaakov, that I will give up my Olam Haba if I don't bring Binyamin back safe. And Yehuda is willing to recognize that what he had done was a tremendous Aveira, and he wants to be Masakin it, and he takes the responsibility for Binyamin's safe return. So this is a midah of enormous importance in Malchus. I mean, even from a political, secular perspective, the notion of a melech saying, you know, I am responsible. I'm not going to look for other people to blame. I will admit when I'm wrong, and I will correct my mistakes to the best of my ability. I mean, it's a tremendously important midah for a melech to have. And this was the malchus based of it. Now, the other aspect of Yehuda, to go backwards a little bit, when we talked about humility, true humility, is also correlated with gratitude. Because when a person is arrogant, there's nothing, they're never grateful, because everything they have is only part of what they deserve more, right? When there's true humility, then one is grateful for whatever HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives them. And this too, of course, is built into the very name of Yehuda. And this is why Leah called him Yehuda. This is recorded in the Torah, HaPam Odes Hashem. Rashi explains what's the circumstance, that Leah knew, right? Leah knows Yaakov has four wives, and she knows Baruch HaKadosh, they're going to be 12 boys. So she figures each wife gets three boys. So the first three coming to her, she's not grateful. The fourth is Hakara Sato. Now I am grateful. Why? The key is Noipalti Yeser Al Chelki. If I have taken more than I deserve, that is what gratitude is. Gratitude is the sense I got more than I deserve. And the Sfas Emes says very beautifully, why are the Jewish people, why are we called Yehudim? After all, Yehudi is only Shevet Yehuda. Now the word Yehudim is usually not used in Tanakh. Usually Tanakh uses Bnei Yisrael. But for example, in the late Sfarim, in Megillas Esther, the Jewish people are called Yehudim. Why Yehudim? Now the simple reason is because after the exile of the Aseret HaShevatim, all you had was Yehuda, Binyamin, and Kohanim and Levim, so Yehuda was the dominant tribe. But the Sfas Emes says a Jew is called a Yehudi because every Jew has to go through life with the feeling of Leah calling her son Yehuda, I have gotten more from Hashem than is coming to me. That's Hakara Sato. Nataldi Yeser Al Chalmi. So Yehuda therefore connotes both gratitude and confession, the ability to take responsibility.
Shouldn't she have been grateful for that first one? Even I mean, she'd given the opportunity to mother
someone
in
Bnei Israel.
We see that in the end it wasn't
Bnei
Israel.
That was
you know,
whole
assumption on her part.
Well, she's
grateful to participate at all.
Well, yeah. Well, again, I don't think the suggestion of the name was that Leah was not grateful. And after all, even Reuven, she says, now Hashem has seen my suffering, etc. But it means that the extra phrase, Hoda'ah is a special level of Hakara Sato, which is the recognition that I don't deserve it. That doesn't mean there can't be gratitude of a different level or another level before that point. Which is, by the way, Hanukkah is called Days of Hallel V'Hoda'ah. Al-Hanisim is called Hoda'ah, which is the gratitude for that which we don't deserve. And that's part of the feeling of Hanukkah. In fact, the Mefarshim say that the whole miracle of Hanukkah is a matnas chinam, is something that we didn't deserve, we didn't even need. Because the halacha is, if you find oil, like you only have one day of pure oil, let's assume Hashem wouldn't have made a miracle. So the next day, how are they going to light the menorah? They light the menorah with impure oil. The halacha is, for a communal offering, you're allowed to use tamei oil. You don't have to have pure oil. So the whole miracle was an expression of Hashem's love, giving us something we didn't even need at that point. It was like a frosting on the cake. By the way, I'm not sure if I mentioned this last week, a lot of people have a misperception, the menorah has to be lit every evening. In other words, you can't, there's people, I think a lot of people think, you know, they lit the Hanukkah menorah, they lit the menorah of the Beis HaMikdash the night of the 25th of Kislev, and it burns continuously for 8 days. That wouldn't be true. Every single night you have to put it out and relight it. So in effect, they lit the menorah 8 times, but the miracle was that the oil never diminished. Yeah,
I don't know if you're ending before getting to this, or we'll do it next time. Having said what we said about Malchus coming from Yehuda, we also know that Bnei Rachel, who deal with Amalek. How is that element of dealing with Amalek separate from the whole concept of a leader?
Right. We think we talked about this last week. We did mention that the Bnei Rachel do have one royal role, and that is the Bnei Rachel are responsible for the eradication of Amalek. That is why there was a Malchus Shaul to begin with. Why did Hashem want Malchus to come from Shaul? It was from Binyamin. The answer is to kill Amalek, eradicate Amalek. That is why the war of Amalek in the Midbar was led by Yehoshua from the Shevet Ephraim. That is why Mordechai from the Shevet Binyamin, Rachel, is the one who tries to defeat Haman from Amalek, right? Mordechai versus Haman is a reprise of Shaul versus Agag, and that is why there's a Mashiach ben Yosef before there's a Mashiach ben David.
And why do I need to make split?
And we actually mentioned this last week. Just to mention very quickly, the basic idea is the Gemara tells us that Amalek can only be defeated by the children of Rachel and not Leah. Part of it goes back to the fact that all the Bnei Leah bow down to Esav in Yaakov's encounter with Esav. They acknowledge it. Part of it is that Esav has the spiritual merit of Kibbutz Aviyim, which none of the Bnei Leah have because they sold Yosef and brought pain to their father. Etc. You know, so there are different cheshbonos that are given, but the concept is that Malchus Beis David comes on the scene only if Amalek is eradicated, and that is why Malchus Beis David, and even in David HaMelech's time, was not complete, because Shaul did not complete the job. In other words, had Shaul completed the job, Mashiach David would have been the Mashiach. He is a Mashiach, but that would have been the final Geula at that particular point. But Yad al Kes Ka, as long as there's Amalek, there is a hand on the throne of Hashem that prevents the complete Hiskalos, the complete revelation of Malchus Beis David. Now all of this was kind of a digression. I don't remember what the main point was here. I'm sorry, say again?
Yeah.
Well, it does not say in the bracha that Esav will be destroyed. It talks about Yaakov having an ultimate ascendancy and rulership over Esav.
So, but here we're all talking about that we're not going to be Malchus and sort of Jews until after eradicated.
Okay, now I didn't say until Esav is eradicated. I said Amalek. Now Amalek is a grandson of Esav, but it's one particular nation.
Esav will still be around.
Right, Esav will still be around. Now, although in the Haftorah we read last week, which is the Haftorah from the Sefer Ovadia, it does talk about Esav being Kash. It describes Vahaya Beis Yosef Esh, that the house of Yosef shall be a fire, and Beis Esav will be Kash, which will be stubble and be destroyed. But nevertheless, that means their power as a nation will be destroyed. It does not have to mean every individual. And remember, we have converts from Edom. And in fact, the Gemara says you can even have a ger from Amalek. An amazing thing. An Amaleki can convert. It says that B'nai Banav Shel Haman. And Haman's children were killed, but apparently he had grandchildren. That descendants of Haman taught Torah in B'nai Brak. That's what it says in B'nai Brak. So we are Makabel. We are Makabel Gerim. In fact, I'll just end with this thought, just because the Chalek is the Chalek. We're Makabel Gerim from all over the place. We're Makabel Gerim from Amalek, if they're sincere. We're Makabel Gerim from the seven nations of Canaan. Yeah.
And weren't we
Well, that's a well-known question. We know that Rashi quotes the Medrash that says that Dina was raped by Shechem because Yaakov concealed her from Esav. Now, let me ask you the question. What's going on here? I have a daughter, and there's this awful Russia that wants to marry my daughter, so I'm going to be punished because I don't want the Shidduch to go through. In other words, how can you possibly condemn Yaakov for doing it? So there are different answers that are given. One answer is that Dina was such a tzedekes that indeed Yaakov should have realized she could have changed even Esav around. In other words, which most of us can't make that judgment. But the Bali Musar say is a little different. The Bali Musar say, Yaakov keeping Dina from Esav is totally appropriate. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. That's what you do. But Yaakov had a certain personal, why do they say it? He slammed the box too shut, too hard. Meaning, it goes back to doing it L'Shem Shemaim. If he's doing it because indeed this is not a good thing, that's proper. But if he's doing it because, you see, I beat my brother yet another time, that little element of personal satisfaction, HaKadosh Baruch Hu treats as a very big avera. So, what Yaakov, his behavior is proper. It's like David and Bathsheba in a way. The behavior is halachically okay, but there was a certain motivation that's improper. But let me just end with the stuff, though. So we have Gerim from all over the place. Even Esav and Amalek
and the second